I want you to imagine that you've been to a wedding and another friend or a relative asks you, hey, how did the wedding go? And you start describing for them. You say, look, this the venue where this thing was held, there was this incredible venue, and there was, you know, exposed brick and steel, and it was just a really cool space. And the way they decorated that space was incredible, with the lighting and the music and the guy that stood up there in the front and officiated it. It was just incredible. And I mean, the dancing, the food, oh, the food was unbelievable. And the drinks that were served, I mean, we just had such a great time. It was such a great, and then like, then at the very end, we got to like light off fireworks, and it was so great. And then your friend says, but what about the bride? And you're like, oh yeah, the bride. I mean, honestly, I didn't really notice the bride. And you'd say, well, you missed, in essence, I mean, what we've made weddings all about, is that woman coming down the aisle to meet her groom, her husband, and become one. And I say this because I think very often we do the same thing with Christmas. And heading into Christmas, this whole Advent and Christmas thing is all about the expectation, the hope, the longing, the yearning for Jesus to come and make things right. And then that celebration of Christmas Day, it's like, yeah, yeah, okay, there are presents and food and family and friends and all. Like, that's great stuff. But the central thing is Jesus. And if we miss him, we've missed the whole deal. And what I want to do this morning is we're going to start in Matthew chapter 2. This morning I want to look at these three characters who missed Jesus. Let's look at why they missed Jesus. And let's look at how, in honesty, in self-reflection, we are very much in danger of missing Jesus for the same reasons today. Now, I'm going to begin this morning with the character of Herod. He is the most famous villain of the Nativity story. And to really understand the story of Herod, we need to back up and hear a little bit about Herod's dad, Antipater. Antipater was actually, they were Idumeans, so they were descendants of the Edomites, who were descendants of Esau. If you remember in the Old Testament, there was Jacob and Esau, and Esau sold his birthright to Jacob, and Jacob became the son of promise. Well, the descendants of Jacob go off, and they become the Israelites. The descendants of Esau go off, and they become the Edomites, become the Idumeans. And Antipater cozied up to those in the Hasmonean dynasty and sought as much power and control as he could possibly get. And one day he finds out that Julius Caesar is not only under attack, but Pompey has surrounded him at Alexandria in North Egypt. He's cut him off from all supplies. Julius Caesar is under siege. And so this Antipater, the father of Herod, he mounts an army of 3,000 men. He goes down there to Alexandria. He goes to war with Pompey. He sets Julius Caesar free. He saves Julius Caesar's life. And of course, this is what he's expecting, is Julius Caesar turns to him and says, thank you so much. What can I do for you? And Antipater says, I'm glad you asked. I have two sons. My oldest son, I would like him to be now the governor of Jerusalem. And my other son, Herod, I would like him to be the governor of Galilee. And Julius Caesar says, of course, I mean, you saved my life, so be it. You know, they're governor and governor. Well, the older brother that's the governor of Jerusalem, he keeps fighting with the Hasmoneans for whatever. He wants more power, they want more power, and they're going back and forth. And finally, the Hasmoneans are about to kill Herod's older brother, and he commits suicide because he doesn't want the shame of being killed by his enemies. Herod, this whole time, has been setting up these alliances to get more and more powerful up in the north. And he says, that's no good. You've killed my brother. I'm going to go and just crush you. So he marches on Jerusalem, and he crushes the Hasmoneans. It's the end of the Hasmonean dynasty. He looks over here and says, oh, the Hasmonean princess, Mariamne, she's the one left carrying the line. I make her my bride. He goes back to Rome, and he presents to them, like, this is what I've done. And the Roman Senate says, wow, Herod, like, you're really impressive. We're going to give you a new title, and your new title is the King of the Jews. Because you have this whole dynasty that you've set up, Galilee and Judea, you rule over all of it. Now, a detail that I didn't even realize that you need to bring into this story in Matthew chapter 2 is that Herod is not a Roman. He actually was a practicing Jew. So he's a practicing Jew. He's converted to Judaism. His father, Antipater, has raised the family to be Jews. He's now been named King of the Jews. You know, some of you know some of these massive building projects that King Herod undertook then. He wanted to ingratiate himself to the Jews. Yeah, I'm a practicing Jew. I'm the king of the Jews. And he would build these things. And, you know, some of the ruins of things that Herod built now, still 2,000 years later, are some of the most magnanimous structures in all of the land of Israel. One of those, of course, was what's called Herod's Temple. This is the temple that in the time of Jesus' life, this was the temple that Jesus would have seen. This temple that Herod built on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, replacing King Solomon's temple that had been partially destroyed, the footprint alone, the foundation alone, was over 1.5 million square feet. Okay, the foundation of this Herod's temple was 2.5 times larger than the Colorado Convention Center downtown. Enormous structure, 172 feet high, 172 feet long, 172 feet wide. And for a little bit of context, the Stapleton Control Tower that you guys pass, 170 feet tall. So he's built this unbelievable structure, and all the Jews are like, oh, we're so grateful for you. You know, you're such a wonderful man. And yet all historians look back at this man's life and would say he was one of the most driven, ambitious men, even of that time period, that everything was about enhancing his own reputation, enhancing his own power, enhancing his own control over other people. And historians say that the main two tools that he used to consolidate power were marriage and murder. Like many historians say, this man was probably married even up to 8 different times, just trying to say, ooh, a princess from here, ooh, a princess from here, ooh, I kill him, I marry his wife, I get more territory. The Jewish Encyclopedia describes him as prepared to commit any crime in order to gratify his unbounded ambition. This is King Herod. And now we come to Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled. I'll stop right there. You see why King Herod is troubled. Because you have magi, basically astrologers, they were not kings. Basically, astrologers from a foreign country, from Persia, coming hundreds and hundreds of miles to your capital city, to your place, to your palace, and they're saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? And Herod would have immediately thought, what do you mean someone's been born king of the Jews? I am king of the Jews. And of course, as we go on in the story, you know, the king, King Herod, is troubled by this. He says, well, oh, where? Like, where are you guys headed? Where is this star taking you? And they all search the scriptures together. They go back to the Old Testament. They land on Micah 5:2 that I read earlier for you. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. So it says, Herod summons these wise men secretly, and he says, how long have you been tracking this star? And they say, you know, however long. It's probably been at least several months. Okay, so by the way, the whole thing about the three wise men at the manger, they weren't at the manger. They were actually in a house by the time that they made it that distance. Well, Herod says to them, you know, you go find where he is. You present your gifts. Then come and tell me where he is at this point so that I may come and worship him too. And of course, you know the story that the angel appears to these wise men after they've greeted baby Jesus and they've given him their gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. And the angel says, do not go back that way. Don't tell Herod because he's going to kill Jesus. And then the angel appears and warns Joseph, the father of Jesus, and says, you know, you need to flee to Egypt to be safe because Herod's coming after this baby. And so he takes his wife, Mary, and baby Jesus down to Egypt for a time. And when Herod finds this out, he flies into a rage, okay? Because you didn't you didn't not do what Herod told you to do. He was the king of the Jews. Okay, so now he's been royally dissed, and he's angry, and he goes back and says, okay, what time did the shepherds, or what time did the Magi say this star appeared? And he figures it out, and he says, okay, now you go back and kill all the babies in that region who are 2 years old and younger. You know, implying that the star had appeared that long previously. And what I want you to see is that, and this is King Herod is obviously missing Jesus big time. But the reason that it really comes down to is Herod is missing Jesus because he didn't want to lose power or control. You know, he is this incredibly powerful, ambitious man. And he hears there's another king of the Jews in town. And this man's birth has been announced by angels in countries far, far away, and people are coming to worship him. And because he wants to consolidate and control this power and this ambition that he has, he says, Jesus, you know, not only am I going to miss him, but he needs to die. He needs to be executed. And I want us to take that principle, and I know, like, nobody's out to kill Jesus here, but I want us to take that principle and understand how we are very much at danger at missing Jesus in our lives today simply because we want to maintain power and control. And I do this sometimes. You draw this little throne, so you know, like a stick figure throne, looks kind of like an H, lowercase h. So if you're taking notes, go ahead and draw like a little lowercase h, okay? Because my point is, every single one of our hearts, we don't think of it this way, but every single one of our hearts has a throne. And there is someone or something that sits on that throne, and it rules what you do. It controls what you do. I mean, something gets your allegiance, something gets your attention, something gets your affection. And my question is, what is that thing, or what are those things that get your attention, your allegiance, and your affection? When you're making decisions, just day-to-day decisions, what is it that you are attached to? What is it that you love, that you crave, that you want more of? And so that's what you serve. You know, these could be things like you have your own ambitions, and not murderous ambitions like Herod, but you have ambitions, you have dreams, you have goals, and you are pursuing those things, and those things have wrapped their tentacles around your life, and those dreams, those ambitions control you. They dominate you. And when people get in the way of you fulfilling those ambitions, those dreams, those goals that you have, it doesn't just frustrate you or make you sad. It makes you violently angry or depressed because it controls you. For some of you, it may be something like your own reputation, like how popular am I? How many people like me? And it controls you because you find yourself saying certain things to these people or this group of people, and you say different things over here. And there's not an integrity to your life or your speech because what controls you is, I want everyone to like me. I want everyone to understand what a wonderful person I am. And your reputation is that which controls you. You know, many Christians in our culture today, it's just simply money, materialism, the American dream. And you look at your neighbors and they seem to just be seeking stuff. And, you know, Christmas is a great time to seek stuff and get some of the stuff you always wanted and you can't afford for yourself or whatever. And you're controlled because decisions are made by how can I leverage people or situations to get more of this material stuff that I want. Some of you are controlled simply by alternate beliefs besides Scripture. And you have ideologies, philosophies that kick around in your head, and you make decisions because of those philosophies, because of those controlling ideas. Some of you are controlled by expectations. It may be your own expectations of yourself. It may be someone else's expectations of you. It could be that you think, you know, if I want to progress, if I want to be the person that I eventually want to be, these people have expectations. I have to keep them happy. And they really get to run your life because you're a slave to those expectations. Some of you, and this doesn't sound as bad, but it's bad, is the thing that sits on the throne of your heart is simply your family, your children. And how many families today, how many individuals today, parents today, are just kind of living vicariously through their children and are like, you know, I want to produce these amazing kids and people will see what a great job I did. And you're controlled by this image of a great family, a great father, a great mother. Some of you are controlled by just the idea of safety and security, and you're not pursuing God's mission for yourself or for the church because you're just thinking in terms of like, well, what's safest for me? And it's a controlling thing. We come back to Herod, and you realize Herod was right in his fears, in a sense, because Jesus was king. Jesus was the rightful king of the Jews. He's in the line of David. You know, and by the way, Herod is not, okay? An Idumean king is not in the line of David. So he had reasonable fears, but he never took the time, because of this lust for power and control, he never took the time to understand what kind of king is Jesus. And I think we do the same today, where we miss what Jesus is all about because we don't take the time and make the effort in faith to say, what kind of king is Jesus? Because what we're missing is the paradox. The paradox that Jesus is the Son of God. He's the king, the forever king. He is the Son of David. He is the king of the Jews. He's all of that. But how would Jesus come and use that kingly authority? He would use his authority. He would use his power to love and serve and sacrifice for and eventually lay down his life for even his enemies. And when we live the way that Herod lived, where we miss Jesus because we just want to make our own decisions. We want control of our own lives. Or we let these other things control us, and we miss the wonder, we miss the grace, we miss the freedom that would have come to us, where Jesus says, like, do you see how that thing that, okay, that on your little throne that you drew, and you got something there besides Jesus, don't be so spiritual that you can't admit this. There's something else there that tends to want to rule your life. Well, in moments of clarity, you realize, I'm not free. I'm not free because that thing that I try to use to serve me because I want to be king of my life, that thing that sits on that throne, in moments of clarity, you realize this thing actually controls me. You know, again, for example, if you want to control other people's expectations of you and their ideas of your reputation, you will find yourself a slave to the very people that you're trying to please. They get to control you. You're not free. Well, Jesus came to set you free. And don't miss that because you want power and control. Now, jump ahead, if you would, to Luke chapter 1. And this may not be a character that's as familiar in the Christmas story, but the second character I want to show you that misses Jesus is a man by the name of Zechariah in Luke chapter 1, Luke 1:5, in the days of Herod, king of Judea. So there's that same guy we just talked about. He's setting the time and place. But there's a priest named Zechariah of the division of Abijah, and he had a wife from the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. And they were both righteous before God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and statutes of the Lord. But they had no child because Elizabeth was barren and both were advanced in years. Now, to stop there for a moment, it's not just saying that they are childless, which they were. There are terms used here in Luke. And by the way, Luke was a medical doctor. So he uses some terms here to say they don't have a child and they never will. Like, it's literally a biological impossibility. And this is the backstory. He wanted this child. His wife wanted this child. They never had this child, and they never will. Now, verse 8. While he was serving as priest before God, when his division was on duty according to the custom of the priesthood, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and burn incense. And the whole multitude of the people were praying outside at the hour of incense, and there appeared to him an angel of the Lord standing on the right side of the altar of incense. And Zechariah was troubled when he saw him, and fear fell upon him. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you will call his name John. And you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great before the Lord. And he must not drink wine or strong drink, and he will be filled with the Holy Spirit even from his mother's womb, and he will turn many of the children of Israel to the Lord their God, and he will go before him," that is, he will go before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready for the Lord a people prepared. And by the way, I say that Zechariah is about to miss Jesus because the promise of his son, John, is attached to the promise of the coming Messiah. And you see it right here, that The angel is actually quoting to him the last words of the Old Testament. So you come to the very end of Malachi. The angel is saying those verses. He's saying, remember how I promised that there would be this forerunner, this man who would come before Messiah. And he would say, get ready, he's coming right behind me. I will introduce you to him. So this angel is saying, Zechariah, this is incredible. It's going to be your own biological son who introduces us to Jesus, this Messiah. Now look at his response. Verse 18. And Zechariah said to the angel, how shall I know this? For I am an old man, and my wife is advanced in years. And the angel answered him, I am Gabriel, who stands in the presence of God, and I was sent to speak to you and to bring you this good news. And behold, you will be silent and unable to speak until the day that these things take place, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time. What's going on here? Zechariah missed it on opportunity one. And you can insert the word almost if you want to, because he's the one of the three that's going to come back around and understand. Because God just says, you missed it, and I'm going to do what I'm going to do anyway, and you're going to end up getting it. But why did he not get it in the first place? The reason is he almost missed Jesus because he couldn't see beyond his own reason and experience. When the angel appears, and this is always one of these laughable portions of Scripture, okay, he's in like the holy place offering incense in the temple. He's the only guy that's allowed in there on that day, because that's how it works. It's like you tie a rope around his ankle in case he drops dead because he's got unconfessed sin. You can at least haul him out. So he's in there by himself, and all of a sudden it's like, hi, Zechariah, how you doing? And he freaks out. Okay, that's in the Greek. He freaks out. He's like, what in the world? And this, he can tell it's an angel then. But he says, why should I believe you? And that's the tone of what he's saying in verse 18. Like, there's doubt. He's saying, I don't believe this. This is not going to happen. You don't understand. This is biologically impossible, verse 18. And the angel's like, yeah, but I'm an angel who stands in the presence of God. Like, you probably shouldn't doubt when an angel who stands in the presence of God comes and brings you a special message from God. And the problem here is that Zechariah sees biological impossibility rather than theological promise. And this is often a hindrance. And I don't just mean biologically, but where science or reason becomes more real to us than the promises of God or the person of Jesus. But I want to go even another layer deep, because you can look at that reason right there and you say, okay, there are a ton of people in our culture today who will continue to miss Jesus because they're like, well, the whole story doesn't make sense to me. Doesn't make sense to my reason. Doesn't seem scientific. You know, all the supernatural stuff, no, everyone knows a virgin doesn't have a child by God, okay? So it's unreasonable. I reject it. But there's something else I want you to see underneath Zechariah's rejection. And that's this word experience. Why do you think Zechariah is rejecting the message of the angel? Why do you think that reason in that moment was more real to him than the promise of God? I think it's because of a lifetime of unmet expectations. I think he has dealt with his wife so much humiliation, because in that culture, it's all about you have kids, especially sons, and you pass on the inheritance to them, and that's what makes you a good person in a traditional culture. And they've dealt with a lifetime, and we don't know what age they are here, but it's like that ship has sailed for them. And day after day of praying and longing and yearning, God, would you please do this? A son would be a great thing. It'd be a wonderful gift. There's nothing wrong with praying for a son, and God didn't do it. And they had given up. You know that verse that says, hope deferred makes the heart sick? I think in some sense, Elizabeth and Zechariah had very sick hearts. I mean, William Shakespeare said, expectation is the root of all heartache. And I think they had this expectation, and it didn't happen, and there was heartache. And so what they saw with their eyes, what they experienced, you know, scientifically, biologically, was more real to them than this promise, this hope. God's not only sending his son, and by the way, if he can send his son into this one little tiny planet, in this one little tiny solar system of this one little tiny galaxy, out of all the billions of galaxies that are out there, I think he can do it through your, you know, through a virgin's womb, and he can tell you and your wife about it. But he had these expectations, and those expectations went unmet for so long. He's crushed. and reason is real to him. So I ask you, what unmet expectations do you have with God? And again, it does no good to sit here and be like, well, that's not a very spiritual thing to say, that I have unmet expectations. Okay, sure. It's not very spiritual, but it's real. We all have things that we thought God was going to do something. He was going to give us something. He was going to take something away. And the reality is, some of you, because you haven't just acknowledged that this is you, you're not just sad and like, oh, that's a bummer. You know, life didn't go the way I thought it would. You feel something less like disappointment and more like anger or despair or just pain. It hurts. And some of you would say, this isn't what my marriage should look like. This isn't what my parenting should look like. I didn't think my kids would turn out like this. This isn't what my career should look like. This isn't what, you know, my vocation. This isn't what my finances should look like. I'm this old. This is not what my finances should look like. This isn't what my health should look like. This isn't what my relationship should look like. This isn't what my church should look like. Some of you would just say, you know, the whole deal, this isn't what my life is supposed to be. And I think, like Zechariah, that self-pity closes the door to the supernatural. Self-pity will cause you to miss Christ. He's right there. He's doing all these things for you. He's showing himself true. He's continuing in the fulfillment of his promises, unhindered by what you think of him. But self-pity makes you miss what he's doing, what he's up to, even in your life, even in your marriage, even in your finances, even in your church. I love this counsel that many of you know, the name John Piper, who's a pastor in Minnesota. I love this counsel. I read this often. He says, occasionally weep deeply over the life you hoped would be. Grieve the losses, then wash your face, trust God, and embrace the life you have. He's like, fine, you don't have the life you wanted. Grieve. Grieve deeply. Kick and scream like you see in the Psalms. And then wash your face, trust God, and get on with the life you have. Okay? You see, this is what Zechariah is doing in essence, is that he grieved and it was still, the pain was still right there. Because this angel of God, like this supernatural spirit creature, is appearing to him and saying, God's going to do this. Your son is going to be the forerunner of Messiah. And he's like, I don't believe you. My reason, my experience speaks louder to me than what you're saying. And when we do the same thing, we miss the joy, the contentment, the peace of just saying, yeah, you know what? My marriage, my career, my finances, my health, it doesn't look like what I thought it would. It doesn't. But okay. This is what God has given me. Where are you at work, Jesus? And I don't mean like, where are you at work? I mean like, show me where you're at work, because I know that you are. Then finally, just one verse. If you flip over to Luke chapter 2, the third character in the nativity story that misses Jesus is the innkeeper. You know, there's a decree from Caesar. Everybody's got to go to their own city, be taxed. Mary and Joseph get up, and they make this journey down to Bethlehem, which is the city of Joseph's origin. Look at verse 6. As they come into this town of Bethlehem, and while they were there, the time came for her, Mary, to give birth. And she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling cloths and laid him in a manger, a cattle trough, because there was no place for them in the inn. There's at least two possibilities with this innkeeper. One is that Mary and Joseph show up, and she's in those birth pangs, okay? She's having contractions. That's what the writer's saying. Again, medical doctor, he probably loved this stuff. Ooh, she's like, time came for her to be delivered. This is what she's going through. He wants you to visualize this. And they're knocking on the door of this, you know, old school hotel. And they're like, my wife, we need a room. And the first possibility is that innkeeper looks at her and is like, no way. No way. My reputation's at stake. I am not allowing this to go down. You know, this big, noisy, bloody, some of you heard the song, It Was Not a Silent Night, right? It was blood on the ground, okay? The whole silent night. Yeah, it wasn't like that. It was, you ever been around when a baby's being born? There's like kicking and screaming, and that's just the mom. And it's very possible that this man has the space physically and just says, I don't have space for you. And the other possibility is that he just literally didn't have the physical room available. That's very possible, that there were enough people that had traveled back to Bethlehem. He has this little inn, whatever. He has a couple rooms. And he'd already given away those spaces, and he didn't literally have the room for baby Jesus to be born. And by the way, if that's what happened, it's kind of hard to blame him, right? Like, I mean, that was my first thought this week, is like, how is he supposed to know? You know, if you're running a hotel, if you're running a restaurant, you kind of like, okay, someone comes to the door and it's like, I need a room for the night. You're not going to be like, well, I'm waiting on, you're just like, okay, you get the room. But then I had this thought, like, wait a second, what if the innkeeper, you know, in Bethlehem, ostensibly a Jew, what if he had believed Micah 5:2? What if he did something like this? What if he thought, I have no idea if the Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem in my lifetime. It's been hundreds of years since that promise. But what if he was? And what if you're that innkeeper? I want you to just put yourself in his shoes, and you believe the promise of Micah 5:2. The Messiah is coming, not just anywhere, but he's coming here sometime. And so in your hotel, you create the Messiah room. And you just say, it's off limits. It's always available. Because I'm not going to miss it when he does come. So I reserve the Messiah room. And when he comes, he's such a special honored guest, he gets the room. And maybe my son will see him born. Maybe my grandson, my great-grandson, but we have the Messiah room. And what you see here in this innkeeper is that he missed Jesus because he had other commitments or priorities. It's that simple. Again, it's like, it's hard to blame him. But he had filled up all the rooms, or if he hadn't, he was just saying, I prioritize the comfort of my other guests over you making this kind of racket in my room on this night. He had other priorities or commitments. And friends, this is how so much of our lives are. That we are not intentionally, deliberately saying, Jesus, I don't have space for you, I don't care. But we say, I do have room, I do care, I love you, Jesus. And then the reality is, we have commitments and we have priorities that just eat up our time, eat up our emotional and our physical energy, eat up our money, eat up our everything. And frankly, that occupy the central place in our hearts. The innkeeper missed Jesus, another way to say it, and I realize this is anachronistic, but he had no bandwidth for Jesus. He had no margin. And what if instead, as followers of Jesus Christ, we just think, I will always, always reserve margin in my life, bandwidth. You know, you can picture that as the margins are out here at the edges. I don't mean it that way at all. I simply mean as busy as you're busiest you could ever get, as strapped as you could ever get financially, you say, I'm going to start with the margins and define the margins first. Jesus gets all of that first. Now, what are some other commitments and priorities that Jesus has led me to fulfill? When I read this story, I think of vacationing in New York City. Often we love New York City, love the big scene of everything, and one of my problems is when I go to New York City, I want to eat my way through New York City. Some of you do this, okay? So you're walking along and you're like, I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't stop and get a slice of New York style pizza or two. Then you're walking along and you're like, oh, actual Jewish deli. I'd be remiss if I didn't get a bagel, right? Then you're like, oh, a cronut. It was invented here. I got to get a cronut. And you're doing one after another, and then you meet up with your friends for dinner and they're like, hey, we're going to take you to this really special place. And you're like, oh man, that all sounds really good, and I have no room because I made other commitments and priorities throughout the day. Well, don't we do this spiritually with Jesus? We come to those opportunities to make something about Jesus, and it's like, you know, I'm satiated, I'm full. I don't have room, I don't have time. And by the way, there is a difference between prioritizing Jesus Christ and prioritizing the bride of Jesus Christ, which is the church. But you also cannot separate those two things. There's no such thing as a person who is central about Jesus Christ and is like, eh, the church, I don't have time. Because Jesus' bride is central to Jesus' affections. And when you're like, I'm with him, you say, what was he passionate about? Oh, this? And this life of mission? Then that's what I'm passionate about. And I want to just conclude these three little mini stories by reminding us that Jesus came into this world, he says, so that you may have life and so that you may have it to the fullest. He's the King of Kings. Come, paradoxically, into this manger with animals on the hay in a little out-of-town place, B-town, to a teenage girl, an unwed teenage mother. But he comes and he's like, I have come to give you hope and joy and peace and forgiveness and freedom and satisfaction and contentment in all things. And this is not the kind of God that you just say, oh, okay, let me see if I have any leftover time or money for you. This is the kind of God that you say, okay, then I will rearrange everything. And this is what I'm encouraging some of you to literally do as you head into a new year. Don't just start and like tweak a little, okay, I need to do better at that. And so you tweak a couple things, then you go right back to what you were doing. This is the kind of God you say, my schedule needs to completely change. The way I spend money needs to completely change so that I can reorder everything around this Jesus and around his love for me and my love for others because he's loved them through me. So which of those three, or maybe it's something else even that's causing you to miss Jesus? Do you want to be in control of your life and Jesus gets in the way of that? Are you still sad or mad about unmet expectations and everything is interpreted in light of that disappointment and you're just too reasonable now? And you just know God's not going to do that supernatural thing because you've been hurt too many times and you're cynical about trusting, or are you just too busy with other stuff that doesn't matter? If there's three problems, there's one solution. Repent and believe. I mean, recognize how you do the same things today. As you hear these stories, as you see why other people miss Jesus, recognize, I'm doing the same thing. In just a moment, I'm going to give you a moment of silence to repent and to confess that and say, Lord, I'm missing you because I'm just too busy about other stuff. The faith part of this is just saying, Lord, I believe you and I believe in you and I trust you so much. I choose to look for you, to focus on you, to make you the center, so I'm not going to miss something that you're up to in my life or my church or my community. And then I'm going to go in faith with the power and the presence of the Spirit, and I'm going to live differently so that my actions put Jesus at the center. And by the way, you do that not once. You don't repent and believe and reorder once. You do it many times a day if you're like me. You look and you say, that little throne in my heart, there's something else there right now, this moment. Lord, forgive me. I don't want to miss you. I believe that you are worthy of me centering my life on. I'm looking to you again. And by the way, that Christmas carol, Joy to the World, the Lord has come. Let earth receive her King. You know those next words? Let every heart prepare him room and heaven and nature sing.